what a thing to follow. I'm going to be talking quite a lot about the work that I've been doing with Cabe, or did with Cabe, and it's just such a pleasure to listen to Anne, because so much of the work that we did was about trying to facilitate and enable clients who perhaps were meeting this whole sort of like challenge head on for the first sort of like time. And sort of like, you know, a bit of handheld, a bit of but it's a bit like, I always thought it was a bit like being a boxer. You had to stand behind the client as they were getting into the ring to sort of like, you know, go for all the rounds with the architects and say, God, get back in there. You know, you can do it. You can really bring it together. And it's just amazing what's been brought together. Alan described me as architect researcher, and I think having practiced architecture for probably about a decade, I've suddenly realised I've spent more time researching and thinking and helping clients think and understand about some of the challenges with the built environment just now more than I've actually sort of like made things. So we'll have to see. Maybe I have to go back to making things. We'll sort of see. As I just mentioned, 7 of those years were setting up the research team for Cabe. And I apologise if a lot of things I'm going to talk about are sort of like quite Cabe heavy. But I'm now currently working with organisations such as the Technology Strategy Board or the GLA. And one of the things I'm finding with different organisations, different sort of like intents, but that need to think about value, that need to think about what are you producing, how is this going to be understood and valued, is just sort of like is true. So, what am I getting to? This issue of, are we talking about architecture, are we talking about design, are we talking about sort of like a process? I'm going to talk a little bit, I'm going to take Cabe's very particular rise and fall as a way of thinking about not just what we did, but the legacy that it's left, and what of those lessons maybe is still sort of like currently relevant. This idea that there are so many varied aspects of design that we have to sort of like try and knit together. And that actually that's really informed by the different ways we have of thinking and understanding and measuring and really sort of like engaging things. And then what does that leave us at the end? Does that leave us with a sort of like a neat tight little picture, or does that leave us with stuff which is, you know, spiraling off somewhere? I'm also a bit infamous for doing presentations which end up with reference lists at the back, and I've avoided doing that here. But there are lots of sort of like slides of reports and pictures and stuff like that. So, you know, that's where I'm sort of like going to be referencing them. So this thing about actually reflecting on, is this the value of architecture? Is this the value of architects? And I think it's really important to sort of like recognise that diversity of the architectural experience, you know, the contribution to society, as we've just heard in the description of this particular building here, you know, there's the sense of the value of this as an object, its contribution to the urban fabric, to the architectural image of Belfast, as a collecting space, a space for theatre and experience. And I think that a lot of it is to be able to sort of think about architecture not as that outcome, but as that process, as that journey, which has been sort of like very nicely sort of like described. So hence, I'm going to be concentrating on, I guess, a lot of the value to be derived from the process rather than just the final outcome, be that a building or a space. And also to reflect on the value of thinking about design and architecture. You know, it's that real sort of like engagement that you have to sort of like mentally do before the thing, you know, to actually sort of like get the thing to be embodied. So this is the short bumpy bit, but maybe not so short. Research into values, research into architecture, very long history, considerable knowledge, not just in the research community, but among practitioners, particularly, you know, that sense of the reflective practitioner who we all sort of like aspire to be. But I think it was fair to say when Cabe was established in 1990, design quality was probably, it was the territory of people like the Design Council. You know, designers and architects, you recognise it in your guts, but how do you actually articulate what it means? Certainly, you know, that's a slight sense that the wide public seeing it as the frivolous, decorative sort of like stuff. And it certainly had no policy or no purchase in policy making. And I think I'd argue that the establishment of Cabe was a first step in actually getting government attitudes to change about the built environment, and this willingness to give design significance in a decision-making. So to have value, something has to be sort of like considered at the beginning. And I think that was really quite a big step to sort of like get that done. And I think Cabe really, we started with this hypothesis, design adds value. very sort of like simple, whether that's in a regeneration process of the urban renaissance, whether it's the Bilbao effect, whether it's that whole sort of, you know, those little design interventions that knit together a sort of like a place. And I think we achieved a huge amount in the early days, just literally through conviction, just through going out and just saying it and telling people. But by the time I got to Cape, it wasn't enough just to say stuff and to sort of like say it a bit brazenly and a bit loudly, you know. It wasn't enough just to be sort of like the boxing coach saying, get back in there. People were saying, okay, yeah, we believe it adds value, but how much? How am I going to persuade my director of finance that I should be doing this? What, you know, come on, give us a sort of like a feel for it. So there was clearly this research gap. It was a lack of evidence base on design quality across the built environment. And the first thing I think we did was actually just trying to bring back research in practice, academic research, and making it available to industry. So we commissioned this joint literature review, The Value of Good Design, and I think its publication, I mean, you can see from sort of like the picture on the front, it sort of captured a particular moment, both for CABE and sort of like the wider population. And it was the start of a very extensive programme of value research. And a lot of what we did was sort of like collate and analyse and translate academic research, as well as commissioning sort of like experimental research and thought leadership projects. But it was all about saying, what can we gather and then reflect back out to people? And that's why I was so pleased to see Reva's publication sort of like from last year, the fact that they've really sort of like picked up and taken on that sort of like, say, mantle. Because there was a real appetite, a huge, huge appetite for sort of like the examples and the case studies and the bits of stuff here. So it's good to know that there's somebody who is still doing that job of gathering and bringing together sort of like information so that it's available for lots of people. But within that sort of little decade, you know, you have to sit there and say, well, was it something about the circumstances of the time? You know, we managed to sort of like establish the value of design as an area that the government would fund. You know, that they would actually fund and support research, not just doing things, but put their money where their mouth was. And I've listed some of the sort of context things, some of the actual aspects which are really about getting the DQI into the Green Book. The Green Book is the way costing was sort of like is done. And getting sort of like the social value of design sort of like recognised in that. Some of these things really hard to sort of like assess was really sort of like important. And similarly, you know, doing some of the really dull stuff about working with procurement. I mean, you know, listening to the AGM today, how we procure buildings, hearing from Anne, actually choosing the right route through, making sure you've got the people who are actually there, that you've got the right procurement options, that you are in a position where you can say value for money isn't cheapest cost. It's about getting the right people together. It's actually getting that optimum combination of whole life cost and quality and what you need. And that's what real value sort of like derives from. Was one of the things that we were trying to do with the OGC and the National Audit Office. And I think we did, you know, there's lots of examples where we actually managed to influence central government thinking. And that filtered down very nicely. We did a lot of work with the Arts Council, which was great, which gave them the license to be able to commission projects which had a broader way of, say, assessing savings over the lifetime of the buildings, rather than simply making a judgment on sort of like initial capital cost. So, you know, you were be able to sort of like work with this equation of, you know, upfront investment to save more in the medium and sort of like long terms. And, you know, it's how do you translate the rhetoric, you know, architectural excellence generates value into a quantifiable task that, as I said before, will enable a finance director, board of trustees to say, yeah, we're going to go with this because we trust what's going to come out of it. So that was very much then. And what is it now? One of CABE's last entertaining research projects was some work which we were doing with a PhD student at UCL, which was very much about architecture in the age of austerity. You know, where was this going to come? But I think, however the external context is out there, there are some sort of like structural relationships which probably sort of like potentially haven't changed. And this sort of like sense of
the construction industry, sort of like, and actually all the separate sort of like pieces that go into it, is really important because the construction industry is seen as such a driver of the economy. And you sit there and you try and quantify it, and you sort of like sit a bit further and you say, okay, so how much is architecture? We're at this bit of professional services, and you know what actually happens, and sort of like compresses here. I think what actually to do about it is probably a whole other conversation. This sort of thing of having got the sort of like balance right. But it has been incredibly powerful and incredibly useful to actually at least have this sort of relationship sort of like set out and thought about. And then in the situation that we're in now, you know, things have shrunk, things are sort of like painful at the moment, but the proportion probably still sort of like will remain the same. What are we going to do to sort of like actually recognise that, you know, how do we divide the pie up amongst all these other people to make sure that the qualities that architects and designers are holding true still sort of like feed through to the rest of the industry? So, I'm not going to talk in detail about sort of like many of these. I'll just sort of like pick out a few, I think, of the things, and maybe I'll just sort of like flick through sort of some of the slides we've had here. But there was a sort of like attempt to sort of show how, in all of these publications, what we were trying to do was capturing economic benefits, say of parks or green spaces, say they're, you know, commercial benefits which are sort of like there. You can describe that in terms of value uplift, and you know, if you have well managed and well planned parks, the squares can have positive impact on the value of nearby properties. But more importantly, as well as those economic ones, it's like, okay, it improves the physical and mental health of people who are using these parks. You know, the benefit for children, young people, reduction in crime, increased biodiversity. It was about saying, come on, let's break this open so it's more than just about sort of like money. And of course, housing, you know, that economic benefit of sort of like high quality housing design and layout, really was, this was, you know, we did this with Savills. This was about sort of like taking on surveyors and the way that surveyors talk about value and say, okay, as designers and urban designers and housing designers, what we're interested in is issues such as you know, what is the impact of density? What is the impact of layout on neighbourliness? You know, it isn't just about the sort of like the volume house builder's delivery model and their business case. It is sort of like much broader than that. How do you really sort of like pull that all together? We did a lot of looking at things like workplaces and impact of sort of productivity. And it's an area which has been studied a lot. There's lots of work on particularly commercial offices. And not just offices, but you know, we were doing work on what is the impact of the design of hospitals on the recruitment and retention of nurses, you know, or with sort of like higher education buildings, were they attracting more students or sort of like not? And some of this really got sort of like quite complex. I mean, you know, this bit of hedonic pricing, I'll talk about that later. One of the big challenges we had was digesting and presenting the data and the findings that we had in a format that was both relevant and interesting and useful to those who are actually sort of like on the ground doing the work. And I think it's a really critical principle of all the stuff that I've been doing. It's about making sure that information is in a format and it gets to the people who need it so they can use it in a way that will actually change and improve what they do. And again, well, I've talked about sort of like some of the other ones, but being able to take on board a sector such as health buildings, where there has been a huge history. I mean, people like Lawson and Firion and a whole series of researchers who have been looking very, very, very carefully in a very evidence-based way about what are the impacts of all these sort of like various aspects. So, you know, speedy patient recovery, a whole sort of series of aspects, you know, design issues such as aspects, windows and views of greenery, and actually how much that reduces patients' time, so therefore reduces cost savings. It's investigated in a really quite a particular sort of way, which is an inheritance of them being part of a medical sector, a healthcare sector, which has a belief in saying, we can take the evidence, we can interpret it, and we can apply it to improving the health of somebody. And I think that was a really useful there were a lot of really useful things about gathering this evidence base and actually interrogating it, and then saying, and how is it going to change? How is it going to improve what's happening with people? And so we did the same sort of exercises for schools, for university buildings, for public realm, even for the quality of well-designed streets. And I think the other thing, and again it's this last one, this last dull sort of cover, the cost of bad design. After all those sort of like positive things we'd found, I think there were still three big challenges about the value research agenda and communicating it both to the architectural profession and to urban designers and to sort of like, you know, the wider design industry. We may have had robust enough evidence to commit to the public sector, but I don't think we ever really fully won over the Treasury. So again, I still think there's an economic case to be made. And we weren't able to balance that sort of, how do you have evidence of economic impact with that bigger picture? We were still being asked for, okay, we want the magic bullet, but better design is irrefutably cheaper and it'll give us more out of the end. And you say, well, you know, it's not going to be true. It's going to depend on you know, how the process of like goes. But the argument that I do think we got across was that the reasons for choosing good design are sort of social and environmental as much as economic. The difficulty that we're starting to explore in the essays in the cost of bad design were the ones that we all know really well. Short-term profit goes to developers, whereas in the long term, the costs of bad design are picked up by the public purse. So, you know, that was an unpalatable message sort of like back in the late, you know, 2006, 2007. It's even more unpalatable now. You know, that's really one of the big lessons of the things we sort of like have to engage with. And I think that sort of sense of you know, even those challenges were about the fact that we were having to address different audiences, a policy audience, an industry audience, a practitioner audience, a whole sort of sense of different people who were sort of like bringing things together. And alongside these different audiences, it was the fact that when you started to talk about design value, you were talking about so many different things. And about sort of 3 or 4 years in, we suddenly sort of realised that what we were going to have to do was be a bit more sort of forensic about breaking these down, you know. And we ended up doing this value handbook. And at one level, it seems a bit dorkish now, but it was a real attempt to identify different types of value that were being produced by architecture and urban design. And Anne, you know, really nicely was sort of saying, it's that thing about, actually, you don't quite understand how the use of, you know, that use value is going to impact on the image value. It's understanding how they all sort of like start to weather. And the reason we called it a handbook was because we were trying to sort of provide, I guess, material argument and material that to say that this discussion about what is valuable should be a two-way dialogue. It shouldn't be a sort of like a little tick box exercise. Yes, we've referred to those. And by opening up that sort of design and development process, making it more transparent, it would provide more genuine opportunities to actually value the built environment, you know, and to be able to say, okay, some of this is about some sort of contribution, some sort of sacrifice, and to explore this idea of public value added, or in the worst case, public value destroyed. Because I think that was always, you know, you can make as many mistakes as good sort of things. We just don't tend to talk about, you know, the disasters quite as much. So I'll flick through these really quickly. Because it's just really trying to flesh out, and it's in detail with case studies and classic, lots of lovely sort of like pictures and things, but just the different types of value that we were sort of picking up underneath these sort of six ones. I think what's really clear about a lot of these were, you can look at them sort of separately, but it's only when they actually come together, it's only when you start to sort of integrate them, that it becomes sort of like really clear. And I think it's exchange value, which, as I say, it's about sometimes taking on surveyors, which gets associated with value most closely. And I'm very fond of the Be Valuable document, and I really sort of like rate it. And it talks a lot about, you know, things like the 1 to 50 to 200 rule about, you know, design this tiny little bit, really, really tiny exercise, then you construct it. And then actually there's this building which has all the costs and sort of like the occupation. Great idea. I think an awful lot, though, of earlier attempts to design for value and for good value have floundered on this sort of like institutional allegiance to cost reduction. This is the fair stuff. You know, it's within the supply chain and the client organisations, and that's the bit you have to save, and that's the bit that you have to save, and that's the bit, and it'll all add up to one big, huge saving. But then you end up talking about price margins rather than actually understanding about sort of like value margins. And I think models of a value which are based on the ratio of what you give to what you get, somehow it's too simplistic. We have to be designing buildings for the future, and the future isn't, you know, it's not certain. It's, you know, who knows where we're all going to be in sort of like 5 years' time at the moment. So perfect information isn't possible. Value lies, you know, it doesn't lie in that deterministic, this is where the future's going to be. But it's understanding a process that can balance that at present stakeholders where the future might be. Where I think understanding things such as tangible value and intangible value and what, you know, some of the factors that affect it, like scarcity and willingness to pay, it gives us a clearer way of describing where we are now and perhaps starting to map out ways of getting to where we want to be. And this rather dull and clunky diagram was a bit of work that we never actually sort of released, but it was part of this sort of like valuing the real world study we did. And we wanted to try and provide, you know, the essential introduction to value methodologies, you know, combined with the evidence of value of design, and you know, now thinking about it, it sounds absolutely painful. But it was really interesting because we had to get to grips with an awful lot of some of these sort of like tools and methodologies and ways of people thinking. I'm just going to pick up three. That's sort of like property valuation stuff which was more about people, and then again stuff which is more about actually people and sort of like how to engage. And you know, here's the hedonic pricing again. Property valuation, that sort of sense of what something's worth, it's almost like that a Latourian black box of what will the market sort of like play. And particularly professional definitions, economist definitions of value, they seem overly complex. You know, it's all a bit of a black art. And what we were trying to do was sort of actually start to understand, you know what, they're just the starting place. That might be the tangible stuff, but we have to sort of like bring more things in. And economists are prepared to sort of like, you know, mention those things, you know, those benefits that you can't charge for. They talk about positive externalities, but they find it really, really hard. So the thing about the blob diagram and the things I'm showing you now was we were trying to find out ways which would start to pick up more on those intangibles and to give them a bit of status. So we started to look at things like stated preference and contingent choice and choice modelling. And these are all mechanisms which are understanding what people are prepared to pay for and what they won't pay for. How much and in what circumstances. You know, it's beginning to sort of, you know, verge on the realm of sort of like environmental psychology. But actually, it was beginning to start to say, okay, so how do you get people, how do you get people to reveal, how do you get them to actually sort of engage with what they're going to get, which I think is critical for achieving a good building. And we went back and we looked at a lot of these sort of multi-criteria analysis tools, and some of the designers in the room will be familiar with the spider diagrams from things like the DQI or Space Shaper. And we liked them because it was about a way of sparking a dialogue, mapping different values, and actually getting a visualization way of getting different users' values very quickly sort of there, so you could see where they were meeting, where they were contradicting, what sort of like was actually happening, how different stakeholders started to feel about things. And from this we started to develop this idea about value maps. You know, what did you need to know, what were the dollar runs of, what were the things you really needed to pin down, what were the things just had to be on the table. They might be intangible and unquantifiable, but they still had to be there because they were the things which really were going to give you, you know, the gut feeling at the end. And that sort of really ended up with this idea that actually the construction and development industry in particular, and aspects of sort of like architecture, have really sophisticated valuation methods for individual buildings. But actually, they don't necessarily extend that to sort of like the wider surroundings by them. And we know much less about the places we love, you know, the places we hate to work, and sort of like what they're like. And we were interested in exploring the idea about how value maps could be used to explore better decision making, ways of capturing, as I said, the less tangible aspects of what people value in places, the things that we love about places we love work, and that it would sort of, you know, we could have more confidence, I guess, in the decision making that we would have there, and actually make a better balance between the social and public values and the more easily calculable price drivers of value. So we had this aspiration of things we wanted to try and achieve. And it comes back always, as we all know, is like, who are we creating this value for? And there's something about having to bring all these stakeholders together to form not just the watertight business case that can be promoted as a viable proposition, but actually the thing which is going to be exciting, which is going to sort of like carry the results sort of like on further. And I think one of the biggest obstacles is the sense that value is subjective, really. One person's value may be not shared with another one. You know, one person's benefit may see somebody else's person's cost. So it is always a process of negotiation. And that sense that value flows from the values held by individuals and organisations actually might make a common definition of value seem really far too hard and sort of like elusive. And this is actually my final slide and reflection. Having spent all this time engaging with how do you do this, how do you gather the case studies that will help people persuade people that this is value, how do you get them to sort of start to think about what's important to them, what's important to sort of like other people, it all started to seem a bit sort of like illusionary again. It all started to sort of like float apart. There's a lovely essay by Nicholas Ray in a book which I really would recommend to sort of like lots of people, which is about the ethical dilemmas of architectural practice. And it's great. It's really sort of like meaty and brilliant. And he takes this idea about the fragmentation of value from Nagel, from an essay he wrote in sort of like 97. Ray talks about judgment based on reality combined with higher ideals, tangible, intangible, the value, the overlooked, and how architects have to find the balance between client objectives, regulatory requirements, social responsibilities, cultural aspirations, and even the autonomous demand of the project itself as a holistic entity. That sense we have sometimes that projects just drive forward, they have to happen, they will do the things that they will do. And Ray reminds us really clearly that design professionals are accountable not just to their clients, who pay them, but a far broader sort of segment of society. Their professional associations, you know, RSU, exactly, thank you, who give them the right to practice, building occupants who have entrusted their quality of life with them, regulatory authorities who will be defending the public interest, the owners and shareholders of the firms who employ them, the project partners they collaborate with, and then that culture of practice to whom they contribute new knowledge and precedence and understanding. All of these people have different values. And I think that results in this mosaic of shifting, reforming patterns of value, which will reconfigure depending on which group or which driver or even which sort of like current economic context you're in. And my final point is that as designers and thinkers, the value of architecture isn't something that we can just claim for ourselves. Ultimately, it's something that we're judged as delivering, judged by a wider society in terms of what we're actually giving. And as such, it's our responsibility to reflect and interrogate, to think really hard about and debate the society that we find ourselves in, and actually where we collectively might want to take that society. Thank you.